Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. A ballistic missile launched by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK, has been strongly condemned by the UN Secretary-General. Antonio Guterres urged the government of DPRK to immediately desist from taking any further provocative actions and to resume disarmament talks, his spokesperson said on Sunday. Over the weekend, Pyongyang state media announced that it had fired the long-range weapon on Saturday. It flew a reported 900 kilometers or 560 miles before landing in the Sea of Japan. UN Security Council sanctions dating back to 2006 in response to the DPRK's first nuclear test banned the development of arms and military equipment by the country. To mark International Mother Language Day on Tuesday the 21st of February, a top UN-appointed rights expert has urged all countries to reject the idea that societies should only have one language, to the exclusion of all others. UN Special Rapporteur on Minority Issues, Fernand de Varennes, reiterated criticism of attempts by many countries to reduce and in some cases exclude teaching in non-official languages. These policies were discriminatory and thinly disguised efforts to assimilate minorities and indigenous peoples, said the Special Rapporteur, who reports to the Human Rights Council in an independent capacity. Mr. De Varennes also called for greater investment in mother tongue communication, as this would help minority and indigenous children gain the literacy and numeracy skills that they need to learn official languages. This is the most effective way of guaranteeing equality and non-discrimination, said Mr. De Varennes, who also noted that languages help communities to share knowledge, memories and history. The rights expert also urged governments to move away from new forms of nationalist majoritarianism that call for only one state language. It's inconsistent with inclusive societies that are respectful of the human rights of linguistic minorities and indigenous peoples, the special rapporteur said. The UN nuclear watchdog IAEA is in discussions with Iran after reports that highly enriched uranium had been detected in the country. In a tweet on Sunday evening, the International Atomic Energy Agency said that Director General Rafael Grossi is discussing the results of recent agency verification activities and that Mr. Grossi will inform the IAEA board as appropriate. News reports have indicated that inspectors found uranium enriched to 84% purity, which would be the highest level to date, and approaching suitability for use in weapons. The UN is to spend $250 million addressing forgotten crises around the world, including the risk of famine in Africa, UN Chief Antonio Guterres has said. The relief funding will come from the UN's Central Emergency Response Fund, Mr. Guterres said, while attending the African Union summit at the weekend. Some 349 million people across 79 countries are facing acute food insecurity, according to the UN World Food Programme. According to the UN's famine prevention expert, tackling the hunger crisis should involve listening to what at-risk communities say they need to survive. Rina Gilani, the UN Famine Prevention and Response Coordinator, has been telling UN News that the situation in the Horn of Africa is especially concerning. From Ethiopia to Somalia and beyond, up to 222 million men, women and children face acute hunger, and multiple famines are looming after years of violent insecurity and climate shocks. After working with communities of pastoralists in Ethiopia, Ms. Gilani explained that parents wanted two things above all else: education for their children and a chance to learn new farming practices, which they could fall back on if conditions continue to worsen.
They were talking about, they're very conscious that there's no rain coming from the sky anymore. And so they themselves would say, without using our climate adaptation language, they would say, teach us how to grow things that will grow when the rain isn't predictable. And so they're very, very clear about what they actually need.
The famine relief coordinator noted that in Somalia and Niger, the UN has successful climate resilience building programs where women and girls play an active role in developing them. What we need to do now is to get them to scale, and that means getting the financing for it, because it can be done. We've proven it, Ms. Gilani insisted. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Lay your hands on the radio!
Boy, we have a show today. Hats off to the
the Gray Zone and Rage Against the War Machine for their demonstration, their rally. It's actually just sort of a rally and turning into, hopefully, a movement. What you could call a non-aligned movement. I've got some clips to play after our lineup of news. You know, we've got the latest headlines from this morning from Democracy Now! And the latest Counterspin Radio hosted by Janine Jackson. And after that, hey, I'm going to play some of these clips. Max Blumenthal, Anya Pomerantz, and the outlaw of Code Pink. Code Pink outlaw, banned, censored by Code Pink. Medea Benjamin, I've got a little short clip from her too, all from the rally at the Rage Against the War Machine last Sunday in front of the Lincoln Memorial. So sit back, enjoy it, and in the second hour, we're going to discuss it with Vet for Peace, combat veteran, John Grant. So let's have some fun today.
Lay your hands on the radio. Lay your hands on the radio there in the home.
It's that psychedelic time of the year. Do you know where your brain cells are?
Log Talk Radio.
You know, there's an enormous industry in this nation that is churning out day after day at the cost of billions of dollars the sensation, entirely erroneous, in the body politic that everything is okay and everything's going to keep on being just the way it is now on into the indefinite future. But of course,
Radio Free Canada
have not purchased that bill of goods.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth.
You can't handle the truth!
Welcome to Radio Free Canada.
Kansas.
I'm your host, Mike Dell, broadcasting from the door. Jefferson County, Kansas.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Turkey, at least six people were killed Monday as two powerful earthquakes shook the southern province of Hatay. The magnitude 6.3 and 5.8 quakes were felt across Turkey's border region into northern Syria, sparking panic among survivors of two even more massive quakes earlier this month, which killed more than 47,000 people in both countries, a toll that's certain to rise in the days and weeks ahead. On Monday, Istanbul's mayor warned about 90,000 buildings are at risk of collapse if a massive earthquake were to strike Turkey's largest city. Meanwhile, a convoy of trucks carrying humanitarian aid crossed Turkey's Baba Hawa border, a crossing into Syria Monday, 2 days after the head of the World Food Program criticized Syrian authorities for blocking access to the area. Aid workers say they're now contending with a shortage of tents for thousands of Syrians in need.
The United Nations and relief agencies have not reached us. In shelters, there are some 200 or 300 families, but we cannot secure tents for them. And if there are tents available, their prices have doubled.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has promised to withdraw from the New START Treaty, the last remaining nuclear arms control agreement between the United States and Russia. Putin made the pledge during his annual State of the Nation address earlier today, where he gave no sign Russia's preparing to end the war in Ukraine. Putin accused Western nations of provoking the conflict.
The Western elites do not conceal their goals. As they say, it's a direct quote, to bring Russia a strategic defeat. What does that mean for us? It means to end us once and for all. It means they plan to turn a local conflict into a global confrontation. We understand it exactly like that. We will react to it accordingly. This is because, in this case, it is about the very existence of our country.
Meanwhile, President Biden is in Warsaw, Poland today, where he's giving a major address on U.S. support for Ukraine ahead of the first anniversary of Russia's invasion Friday. Biden's also meeting with leaders of the 9 countries on NATO's eastern flank, including Polish President Andrzej Duda. Biden's trip to Poland comes a day after he announced a $500 million worth of additional U.S. weaponry for Ukraine during a surprise visit to Kyiv, Ukraine. The French army has left Burkina Faso, officially ending its military operation in the West African country less than a month after leaders asked France to withdraw its contingent of hundreds of troops. Their departure marks a significant step in scaling down France's military presence in Africa's Sahel region. Protesters had long denounced a 2018 military accord that allowed French soldiers to fight armed groups in Burkina Faso, saying France's army had done little to actually tackle violence that's engulfed the country in recent years.
We don't want them on our territory because when they are here and our people die, they do nothing. If they stay beyond the exit date, authorities should expect us in their base because we are going to go there.
The medical humanitarian group Doctors Without Borders has suspended its work in Burkina Faso after armed assailants killed 2 staff members earlier this month. In Mexico, at least 17 asylum seekers were killed in a bus crash in the state of Puebla Sunday afternoon. Most of them came from Venezuela, Colombia, and Central America. The bus was carrying 45 passengers when it turned over on the highway as it headed north toward Mexico City. This comes just days after a bus carrying 66 U.S.-bound migrants plunged off a cliff in Panama last week, killing at least 39 people, including children. Rights groups warn Cambodia is ratcheting up its crackdown on free speech and human rights after Prime Minister Hun Sen ordered one of Cambodia's last independent news organizations to shut down last week. He accused the outlet, Voice of Democracy, of attacking him and his son, who's also presumed successor. This is Saul Winis, media director at Voice of Democracy.
They feel like VOD has been playing a key role or important role in Cambodia in bringing the voice to the voiceless and also vulnerable people, and by bringing all the issues to the government. So without VOD, we just afraid that this could be a big step back of press freedom in Cambodia.
In Iraq, prominent environmentalist Jassim al-Assadi was released last week, 2 weeks after he was kidnapped near Baghdad. The motivation for his abductions remains unclear. The Goldman Prize-winning activist is head of the group Nature Iraq, which fights for the protection of Iraq's southern wetlands as they face increasing challenges due to the climate crisis. In Ohio, one person was killed and 12 others injured Monday as a large explosion tore through a metal factory outside Cleveland, shattering windows, scattering debris around the site, setting vehicles on fire. Residents of Oakwood Village reported a scent like burning oil after the explosion, which sent a huge plume of smoke billowing into the sky. Records from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, show the factory's operator, I. Schumann and Company, was recently cited in several complaints. In one instance, a worker suffered third-degree burns. In another case, OSHA cited the company for a serious violation over its control of hazardous energy. Meanwhile, the Ohio Department of Health is opening a health clinic today for residents of East Palestine who've reported health effects in including headaches, sore throats, and respiratory problems following the February 3rd derailment of a Norfolk Southern train. The crash led to a massive fire and release of toxic chemicals, including vinyl chloride. The head of the Environmental Protection Agency, Michael Regan, is headed back to East Palestine today. His trip comes as Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg is coming under fire for not visiting the crash site. Buttigieg told reporters Monday, quote, "When the time is right, I do plan to visit East Palestine. I don't have a date for you right now," Buttigieg said. To see our coverage of the Ohio rail disaster, go to democracynow.org. Students at Michigan State University returned to classes Monday, 1 week after a gunman's rampage left 3 students dead and 5 others critically wounded. Many MSU students and faculty reported they weren't ready to resume classes and need more time to heal. Meanwhile, hundreds of students and their supporters gathered at the Michigan State Capitol Monday for a sit-in protest demanding Michigan legislature put new limits on guns. This is MSU senior Maha Kangra.
I texted my family, friends, and loved ones for what I thought would be the last time ever. The Wi-Fi and data kept going in and out, and for every minute over 4 hours, I thought I was going to die. I didn't think I was going to make it out alive anymore. While I'm standing here before you today lucky to be alive, I should not be lucky to be alive. The right to bear arms should have never come before our right to live, and my life matters more than guns.
And journalism's prestigious George Polk Awards have been announced. Among the 2022 winners is former Democracy Now! Producer Sharifa Belkadus, a reporter for the independent Egyptian outlet Matamasser. Sharif won the Foreign Television Award for the killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, along with senior producer Kavitha Shakur and executive producer Leila Al-Aryan. The remarkable documentary investigates the killing of Palestinian-American journalist and longtime Al Jazeera correspondent Shireen Abu Akleh by Israeli forces last May during a raid in the occupied West Bank. It draws on videos and eyewitness accounts of Abu Akleh's killing to establish that she was fatally shot in the head by an Israeli sniper, a finding supported by numerous other press investigations. Shireen Abu Akleh and other reporters were wearing blue helmets and blue flak jackets, clearly emblazoned with the word press. Sharif Abdelkadous and Leila Al-Aryan were working for Al Jazeera's fault lines. To see our interview with Sharif Abdelkadous and Lina Abu Akleh, niece of Shireen Abu Akleh, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, an expected to
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate news media tend to take the State of the Union address as an opportunity to talk about messaging and whether the president's message is landing well with, first of all, other legislators and then somewhere in there, the U.S. public. A better mediaverse would start with the impact of official actions, not just on the people who donate or even the people who vote, but on everyone whose lives are shaped by government policy. So on just a couple of points raised, to the extent that most of us are hearing about fentanyl, it's likely to be news stories saying that just touching the drug is enough to lay you out. Or, more recently, stories about Mexico and China and why they want to poison us. What elite news media and politicians aren't having yet is a conversation about drug use and harm and whether saying really loudly how far under the prison you'd like to put dealers is really an admission of failure to address a public health issue as a public health issue and to put human beings over table-thumping rhetoric that goes nowhere. We'll hear from Maritza Perez Medina. She's the director of the Office of Federal Affairs at the Drug Policy Alliance about the current state of affairs around fentanyl. Also on the show, the Washington Post editorial board says a discussion on Social Security needs to happen sometime and sooner rather than later. That's because these entitlements, they say, already account for a third of federal spending and are on unsustainable trajectories. When is the last time you heard from media that the Defense Department's unending trillions are unsustainable? Why is it just about whether your grandfather, who paid in his entire life, should maybe get ready to get nothing at all? Elite media seem to be ever stumped about why they can't sell their and Republicans' image of Social Security as a weird communist mistake to a public that just doesn't see it that way. So once more with feeling, We will revisit the reality versus the fantasy of Social Security, with some pieces of an ever-relevant 2018 conversation that we had with Nancy Altman, president of Social Security Works. That's coming up, but first a quick look back at some recent press. Gary Camilla's red-baiting New York Times review of Malcolm Harris's book Palo Alto is clear on its concept. Quote, Karl Marx's long shadow darkens every page, close quote. Okay, but in service of what we are evidently supposed to understand as a non-ideological corrective, Camilla makes a frankly false assertion about the persecution of Japanese people that amounts to denial of one of the most shameful chapters in U.S. history. The Times should issue an immediate correction and apology. Camilla complains that Malcolm Harris cites the case of sculptor Ruth Asawa, who was interned along with her family and then formally excluded from California. Camilla says that Harris's implication is that all artists of Japanese heritage were banned from the state, but, quote, this is not true, close quote. Except that it is true that Japanese nationals and Japanese American citizens were banned from California beginning in March 1942. As Personal Justice Denied, reported the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians explained, under the U.S. Army's interpretation of President Franklin Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066, quote, all American citizens of Japanese descent were prohibited from living, working, or traveling on the west coast of the United States. The same prohibition applied to the generation of Japanese immigrants who, pursuant to federal law and despite long residence in the United States, were not permitted to become American citizens, close quote. Japanese residents of some lightly populated areas of eastern California were not initially subjected to the ban, but the exclusion was extended to the entire state in June of 1942. While the initial plan was to allow people ethnically cleansed from the West Coast to relocate to other states, that was deemed impractical. And concentration camps, yes, were set up to confine them. As the commission report put it, quote, the evacuees were to be held in camps behind barbed wire and released only with government approval, close quote. So what is offered in support of the assertion that Harris is writing that artists of Japanese heritage were banned from the state is not true? Well, this is Camilla's entire argument. Quote, to take just one example, the artist Chiura Obata, who was on indefinite leave from his professorship at Berkeley while interned at Topaz, was reinstated by the University of California president Robert Sproul in January 1945, close quote. So the fact that a person released from a detention camp after the War Department rescinded the ban on Japanese residents in California was allowed to get his job back means that that ban wasn't real and to talk about it is untrue. Camilla treats the fact that Japanese exclusion didn't continue forever as a damning indictment, and he thinks we'll all nod along with the idea that, quote, selection bias, clearly driven by Harris's conviction that positive stories are simply window dressing, concealing capitalism's dark reality, severely damages, close quote, the book's credibility. If the New York Times wants to bring forward feel-good stories about U.S. treatment of official enemies in wartime, well, they're welcome to. They just don't get to use falsehoods to do it. The paper should correct this error. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. When it comes to drugs, that is to say, when it comes to drugs whose use by some people in some contexts is officially deemed illicit, to suggest any other approach than criminalization is to be told you aren't taking the issue seriously, that any response not involving jail, prison, loss of livelihood, family separation is widely deemed essentially a non-response, is indication of an impoverished state of conversation. But is that changing? Some pushback to the White House policy addressing fentanyl suggests that there is space for a new way to talk about drugs and harm and ways forward. Maritza Perez Medina is the director of the Office of Federal Affairs at the Drug Policy Alliance. They're online at drugpolicy.org. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Maritza Perez Medina.
Thank you so much.
Well, what, first of all, does current policy with regard to fentanyl look like? It seems like states, and I know you look at federal affairs, it seems like states are rushing to do something, but the things that they're doing are not necessarily well-grounded or based in understanding of what we know works. How would you describe kind of the current state of play with regard to policy here?
Well, unfortunately, I think at the moment we're experiencing a lot of media sensationalism, but also sensationalism coming from lawmakers around fentanyl, rather than thinking about policy solutions that are based on public health. Because when we're talking about overdose deaths and overdose deaths related to illicit fentanyl, we're really talking about a public health issue that requires a public health response. We know from decades of research that the criminal legal system and a punitive enforcement strategy does not help people who use drugs, does not save lives, and certainly does not reduce the drug supply. If anything, it can lead to a more dangerous drug supply.
Well, that seems important to go on, because I think to the extent that folks who aren't experiencing it personally in their lives, what they get from news media is, first of all, that weird round of coverage of police officers apparently being laid out on the street from just touching fentanyl, which was debunked or at least explored subsequently by media. But it's really kind of sensationalist scare tactics, or it's genuinely hard stories about people who have lost loved ones to overdose. But it's not necessarily a public health conversation or even a sort of research-based policy conversation. It's very much scare tactics and heartstrings in a way that doesn't necessarily tell us what to do about it.
Yeah, and I think those narratives are harmful. For one, you know, the myths that we're seeing around fentanyl are not helpful, because it's essentially just creating more stigma around people who use drugs. And we know that that stigma essentially is going to harm people, especially people who may have used fentanyl, because they're going to be reluctant to want to call for help if they need it. Folks are going to be reluctant to want to call for help if they witness an overdose because of potential law enforcement involvement. Or people might even think that, you know, if they help someone who's overdosing, they themselves will be exposed to fentanyl, which is not true. Rather than perpetuating these myths, we should really be having a conversation that's grounded in public health education and knowledge. The fact of the matter is, fentanyl is in the illicit street supply. We need to make sure that people who use drugs are armed with information that will keep them safe and that will keep them alive. So people should have access to things like drug tracking tools so they can check their drugs for fentanyl. They should have access to harm reduction tools like clean needles, things like naloxone that can help reverse the effects of an overdose. These are real tools that we know save lives and keep people healthy. Unfortunately, a lot of the myths that we're seeing perpetuated in the media and even by lawmakers are really not helpful to keeping people safe.
Well, did the State of the Union change anything for you? What did Biden's remarks suggest to you about what might happen at the federal level and what we might expect to be repercussions of that?
On one hand, I acknowledge that the Biden administration has really embraced harm reduction and even says harm reduction out loud. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're the first administration to really do that,
right,
and to be supportive of those efforts. So I think that's great. It's outstanding. You know, I give them a lot of credit for doing that and for really acknowledging that drug use is a public health issue and we need to meet people where they're at. But on the flip side of that, during the State of the Union, I heard a lot of talk about supply-side interdiction. And we know that prohibition and supply-side interdiction have done nothing to quell the supply of illicit fentanyl. If anything, those tactics have made it so that we have a dangerous illicit supply of drugs in the U.S. This is the fourth wave of the opioid overdose crisis, and it's been driven because of law enforcement tactics, criminalizing various substances, which means that people move on to another substance that they can find more easily. My fear is that if we keep focused on supply-side interdiction, we know from 50 years of failed drug war that that strategy doesn't work, that we will see new substances emerge, and that the public health issue will remain, which is why we really need to focus on a public health response. We need to make sure that people who use drugs are using drugs safely and are staying alive, and that we empower people with education around drugs.
Well, are there particular policies at a state or federal level, either that are drafted and ready to be acted on, or that you think could be created tomorrow that would actually change things? Are there particular policies in the works or that we might think about?
So I think the most concerning policy at the federal level, and it's concerning because usually what happens at the federal level is, you know, mimicked by localities in different states, but there has been an effort over the last few years to criminalize fentanyl-related substances and schedule them as Schedule I drugs without fully testing these substances. And that is really concerning because, one, it's a criminalization approach to this issue, which we know is really a public health problem. But it would impose new mandatory minimums on people who are caught with fentanyl-related substances. And, you know, we know that, one, people who sell drugs and people who use drugs are often the same person. Like, I think, you know, lawmakers like to pretend that we're talking about two different populations, but often they're one and the same. And we know that criminalization is not going to give people the support they need to end problematic drug use. So the criminalization approach doesn't make sense for that purpose. Rather, I think Congress should embrace public health alternatives. And there are a number of bills in Congress that would support harm reduction services, health services for people who use drugs, would support things like education so that, you know, people have knowledge related to drugs. We think that those bills should be ones that lawmakers move in Congress. But unfortunately, just because criminalizing things continues to be incredibly popular with some politicians. Mm-hmm. So it's been hard for them to drop that notion and instead really truly embrace science and public health. But we're trying to explain to them the potential ramifications of continuing to choose criminalization versus public health.
Well, finally, I have to say I was struck by how Associated Press's piece about the State of the Union and fentanyl in particular, it was called Biden's Fentanyl Position Sparks Criticism from Two Sides. But it led with harm reduction advocates who, as it put it, think a call for strong criminal penalties is the wrong way to go about it. It started with that, and it actually gave voice to that perspective ahead of, at least semantically ahead of, the people who were hollering about border policies. And that was kind of, after I turned off the cynic in me that was like, where was this when we were talking about crack cocaine? But still, the idea of harm reduction advocates taking the lead in a news article about a drug was something a little bit new for me. And I just wonder if you see anything shifting in media coverage of these issues, or if there is something in particular you would like to push reporters to do when it comes to this.
I think any issues actually related to drugs and crime, I think it's really important for reporters to look at the facts and not continue to perpetuate what they think will drive clicks. I think oftentimes, unfortunately, news is driven by clicks, but when we're talking about drug use specifically, that could be really, really harmful. We don't want to push people away from seeking help if they need it, especially when we're looking at a drug supply like we have today that is incredibly dangerous. If anything, we want to encourage people to seek out health services. So just making sure that we're not using stigmatizing language, supporting criminalization publicly is really important in order to save lives.
We've been speaking with Maritza Perez Medina, Director of the Office of Federal Affairs at the Drug Policy Alliance. You can find their work online at drugpolicy.org. Maritza Perez Medina, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
There is so much myth and misinformation caught up in corporate media's presentation of Social Security and of the unending efforts to cut it, to get at it, to take that money away from working people who paid into it for reasons that amount to so much moving target, blah, blah, blah. that it's media criticism 101 at this point to debunk those misdirected and malintentioned narratives. Yet, here we are again. Just to gird us for the current fight, we will hear again from Nancy Altman, president of the group Social Security Works, board chair at the Pension Rights Center, and the author of, among other titles, The Battle for Social Security, From FDR's Vision to Bush's Gamble. We spoke with Altman in 2018 when then-Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell tipped a poorly hidden hand by saying that, were it up to him, Congress could be looking to address Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, which he called the real drivers of the debt. Corporate media at that time were quick to report Democrats' outcry, but the reporting didn't include any questioning of media's own role in laying the groundwork for those claims that Social Security is a controversial program or a troubled program or a program in urgent need of addressing. Well, let's start with what Mitch McConnell just said when the Senate Republican leader was talking to Bloomberg on October 16th. He called Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid the real drivers of the debt and lamented both parties' unwillingness to address or adjust them. Now, some people must have thought, did he accidentally say the quiet part loud and the loud part quiet? You know, Social Security is famously so popular that it's described as the third rail of U.S. politics, and here he's saying, shame if anything were to happen to it right before an election. But if it was maybe brazen, McConnell's claims are in a long tradition, aren't they?
Yes, and I think you really captured it perfectly in your introduction. This is an ideological fight. This is about values. But the side that is opposed to Social Security, President Dwight Eisenhower, in a private letter to his brother, described opponents of Social Security as negligible in number, a tiny splinter group. Unfortunately, that tiny splinter group now holds reign over the Republican Party. But they understand the politics well enough to not say, we think Social Security is socialism, we don't think government should be doing this. They say, oh, we love it, but it's driving the deficit. The reality is that Social Security does not add a penny to the deficit. It's totally self-financed. It is an earned benefit that we all contribute to. It's got to have a balanced budget, and it always has. And no other but conservative President Ronald Reagan, you can go on YouTube, and we've got a great clip of him saying exactly that Social Security has nothing to do with the deficit. But this is a line that Mitch McConnell is using, and I think he's feeling defensive because, of course, their tax cut to millionaires and billionaires and big corporations blew a hole in the federal budget, $1.5 trillion. And now they're trying to look around and explain, no, it wasn't us that did it. And so they're going after their favorite targets, which they oppose on ideological grounds.
Well, and they have something to work with because media, I think, have not done a terrific job of making so concretely clear the realities of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid that when you hear these Republican claims, you can say, oh, wait, I know that's wrong. You know, I think, in fact, media have some active untelling to do, having spent decades kind of enabling this storyline. You unpack and address the storyline in your book, The Truth About Social Security, and I would really like to just walk through, you've started to already, but walk through some of the myths that seem just so difficult to dispel.
No, you're exactly right. And let me, before we get to the myths, talk about the role of the mainstream media. Because as I mentioned, Dwight Eisenhower called the opponents a tiny splinter group, which is true, but they have oversized influence.
Right.
Because they are literal billionaires. I mean, the obvious are the Koch brothers, but there's another who died recently, Pete Peterson, who spent before his death $1 billion of his own wealth to spreading the lies about Social Security. He was dedicated to this and set up a lot of organizations. So you'll talk to various organizations, Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, and all of these that sound very independent and objective, but they've all been funded by the same group and they have the same message. So the media, and I must say mainstream politicians too, the elites in Washington, you know, they go to the same cocktail parties, they've bought into this. Yes. Fortunately, the Democratic Party has emerged and returned to its roots and seen the light. And they now are calling for expanding Social Security, while the Republicans are still saying, we've got to save Social Security. It's, you know, it's, we love it, but we can't afford it, and other nonsense like that, which are some of the myths where I think we'll be getting into.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I was just going back through FAIR's archives on this, and it's, there's just no shortage. I mean, here we have NPR Scott Simon. This is 2004. No one would deny that Social Security is headed for a major crisis. The crash, in a sense, has already begun because thanks to the baby boom, there are fewer Americans paying into the system. So that's what sets up this idea of what is ultimately, of course, a goal of privatization being packaged as rescuing a system that's in crisis.
Exactly. It's all the same rhetoric. And this billionaire-funded campaign has been unsuccessful in actually cutting our cash benefits, but it has been successful in a couple of ways. One is that part of what Social Security is supposed to provide, in addition to wage replacement, is a sense of peace of mind, security. It's in its name. The idea that if the unimaginable happens and you become disabled and can no longer work, if you die prematurely leaving young children, or if you are fortunate and live to old age, you are secure in the knowledge that you have a benefit you've earned that will provide for you and your family.
Right.
And that's something we've all contributed to and paid for. So we've lost that. And the way that we've lost it is that you ask most Americans, especially younger Americans, if they think Social Security will be there for them, and they say no. And that's just wrong. The projections by the Social Security Administration, even if Congress were to do nothing over the next 75 years, the end of the 21st century, there would still be enough revenue coming in to pay 75 cents on the dollar. Now, that's not enough. We want to have 100% on the dollar, but the idea that the program won't be there would take an act of Congress.
Well, I think it's such an important point to say that the opposite side to this right-wing push to gut these programs is not, oh, please, can we please hold on to them? It's actually to expand them, and that would actually be more in keeping with the founders' vision of what Social Security was meant to do.
Absolutely. The wonderful part of Social Security, there are a number of things. One is that what makes this such a good issue for those who are on the right side of it is that the winning politics is also profoundly wise policy. We, as a nation, are facing a looming retirement income crisis with the collapse of the defined benefit plan, stagnating wages, loss of home equity, and so forth. The one part of our retirement income system that continues to work extremely well is Social Security. What we need to do is build on what works, expand Social Security. And to be very clear, this myth of, oh, it's going bankrupt, it's unaffordable, the question of whether to expand or cut Social Security is a matter of values. We are the wealthiest nation in the world. We are at the wealthiest moment in our history. And this legislation that's been introduced, there are about a dozen bills that various ways of expanding Social Security and paying for it, they show unequivocally that if we want to expand benefits, we can do so responsibly. But the other side does not want to make this a question of values because the American people overwhelmingly, whether you're conservative or liberal, Republican, Democrat, all genders, all races, everyone, we all overwhelmingly agree that Social Security works. We don't want to see it cut. We'd like to see it expanded.
That was Nancy Altman from Social Security Works talking with Counterspin 5 years ago, but with absolute relevance for today. They're online at socialsecurityworks.org. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Now, coming up is clips, audio clip from the February 19th Rage Against the War Machine. And here is, and we'll still have John Grant. John will be on the second hour to comment on some of this. Here is Anya, I'm sure I'm going to get her name. She's from the Gray Zone, a correspondent there. Anya Pomperil, I'm not sure. Here we go. I picked this one because she addresses these sectarian groups that refuse to participate in the rally.
Hey, everybody. Thank you, Nick. How is everyone today? This is beautiful. I mean, who could hate this country looking out at it? Look how lovely everything is around us. We have a beautiful day. If only all this were used for good instead of evil right here in the heart of the empire. Look at it. Did anyone come here to D.C. in order to get here? Did they cross state lines? Great. I love to see that because the whole point of this is to overcome barriers, not just ideological barriers or physical barriers as well, to come together and say that we're tired of this war, as many of the speakers have mentioned before me. So I'm honored to be here. I want to, as others have, emphasize how inspiring it is to see former presidential candidates, four of them, Dr. Jill Stein, Tulsi Gabbard, Ron Paul, and Dennis Kucinich. They each had their own flavor, but they all decided to show up today because they recognize that even though they each come from something different, we don't always get the opportunity to come together and show what this country is actually about, which is what I see in front of me today. I'm also disappointed that there are some people who couldn't share the stage with me today. Is Scott Ritter in the audience? I want to give it up to Scott Ritter. He unfortunately couldn't speak today, but I just want to point out that more than anybody on this stage, Scott is actually someone who knows what it feels like to risk and lose everything. And he did it in order to stand up to the greatest humanitarian catastrophe so far this century, the Iraq War. So thank you, Scott. Unfortunately, even though she's back here with us, you know her and love her. I do too. Medea Benjamin, a legend of the anti-war movement. She couldn't be on stage speaking. And I don't hold that against Medea because I understand what she's up against. But what I do reject are the individuals and the groups who, instead of asking to be a part of this or working with us, having a conversation, they invested all their time into attacking us, smearing us in the most cynical way. And the reality is, building an anti-war movement is not about building anybody's personal vanity political project. It's not about building even necessarily individual parties. It's putting all of that together over the one umbrella of ending the war. We don't have the luxury in the grassroots when we're fighting for something to say that we want to play clubhouse politics and that we want to sit in the same houses, talk to the same people that we've been talking to for, in some cases, decades, other cases, years. And everybody thinks the same. Everybody looks the same. That's not fun, that's not growth, and that's definitely not building a movement. So I actually think it's great that people can come together and discuss the areas where they disagree. And, you know, we can debate whether or not teenage girls should have to share locker rooms or compete in athletics against biological males another time. Because the reality is, if the people who run this country right now continue down this path, those other questions aren't even going to matter. They're not going to matter. We all know the stakes of this war. And our job in the grassroots is to understand the stakes of the war and communicate to the people the stakes of the war and the cost of the war. And I mean all the U.S. people, regardless of what they believe in on other issues. We are all affected by this, not just in terms of the taxpayer dollar cost. I mean, we should be communicating to people that the price of gas at the pump, the price of the food they're buying right now, is all tied to this war. You think sanctioning Russia's oil means that Russia's not going to make money off their oil? No, it just means we're sanctioning ourselves, not able to buy that oil, and then suddenly the price of oil goes up. I wonder why that is. So it's about communicating the stakes and the real cost to people who might see the war itself as abstract. But it is also, I think, about being serious about what we're actually living through right now. I hear a lot of people talk about the lead up to World War III, and that's what we're experiencing right now. Hello. I would actually argue that we're already living through World War III, because the world war that we are going to experience, or that we are experiencing in our generation, is not this of the same nature as the world wars past. There's not trenches. The nature of the war is different. The battle is different. It's a hybrid war. They have economic sanctions that they levy as part of this war. They wage a media war through your mind now, not just on the television, but through social media as well. And there's a proxy war. There's a covert aspect, which is what we're seeing play out in Ukraine. Don't think for a minute that it's a war between Ukraine and Russia. It's a war between the United States and Russia, and our leaders openly say it. You've heard them all, the biggest cheerleaders of sending more war to the front line in Ukraine, always make this really odd point. They say, no, it actually is a good investment because we can give them the money and they'll fight the war and we don't have to. Haven't you heard that? You've heard them say it over and over again. I heard Hillary Clinton say it. I hear Lindsey Graham make it. And the people who say that, they are so demented because they are openly stating that their whole vision for the war is dependent on their ability to send every last Ukrainian father, son, brother, friend onto the front line. They are happy to fight to the death of the last Ukrainian. The United States is. And so standing here and organizing something like this is actually the real way to stand up for Ukrainian lives, because the war, they are the ones suffering the most. Yeah. And so that's why it is up to us to be serious about communicating the stakes and the cost. And just to point out one more time that the same system that is responsible for the train derailment in Ohio, where a corporation and the government basically now have nuked an entire U.S. city, is the same system that blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, creating the greatest environmental catastrophe of my lifetime. It's a corporate, oligarchical system. It's a militarist system. It's evil and it's rotten to the core. And when we are clear about those objectives and about the stakes, it's not so hard to put away our differences and to come together and rage against the war machine. So thank you all for doing it. Thank you for letting me speak. Thank you to Nick and Angela once again. And no more war!
There you go. Now coming up, this is quite a gathering. I was really... I'm hypnotized, listeners. I know some of you listeners out in Kansas, many of you are libertarians who listen to Radio Free Kansas. We actually sort of got our start from the libertarian trend broadcasting since August of 2007. We've always had the libertarian tinge. And I sort of really dug it. I was watching some live streams the day it happened. And it's definitely got a libertarian edge to it. This was beamed in by the infamous anti-war guy named Roger Waters, who played in the band Pink Floyd, what exists of it. And I really got a kick out of it because one of the handmade signs at the demonstration was drop acid. Drop acid, not nukes. Here's Roger Waters.
Welcome! I have to shout because I'm in Switzerland. Can you hear me? Okay. When I was a young man, my mother once told me this. Roger, throughout your life, you will be faced with many difficult questions and quandaries. My advice to you, when you are, is this. Read, read, read. Listen to all sides of the argument, especially from those you don't always agree with. Research thoroughly. When you have, you will have done all the heavy lifting. The next bit is easy. So what is the next bit, Mum? Then you just do the right thing.
The invasion of Ukraine by the Russian Federation was illegal. I condemn it in the strongest possible terms. Also, the Russian invasion of Ukraine was not unprovoked. So I also condemn the provocateurs in the strongest possible terms.
So, on behalf of the silent majority, I now address President Biden. Let us be very clear, Mr. President. I speak for the voiceless majority. You and Antony Blinken and Victoria Nuland and Jake Sullivan and the rest of the warmongering neocons at the heart of government here in Washington, along with the vassal states in NATO, are the principal provocateurs that I mentioned. I am not apologizing for Mr. Putin, you understand, but just a glance fleetingly back at the history of the last 30 years or so, you could have done better. You could have followed President Gorbachev's lead in 1989. You could have kept Secretary of State Baker's promise not to advance NATO 1 yard closer to the Russian border than the eastern extremities of a reunited Germany. You could have responded to President Putin's overtures in his famous 10th of February 2007 speech at the Security Conference in Munich and shepherded us all towards a much, much safer Europe. Or, in 2008, you could have chosen not to expand NATO eastwards. Or, in 2014, you could have refrained from engineering the illegal Maidan coup d'etat in Ukraine. Or, in 2019, you could have supported the Minsk Accords. Now, we're told by Angela Merkel, they were just a ruse to buy time to arm Ukraine for the war that you were engineering. But they were also, the Minsk Accords that is, the platform that President Zelensky ran on during his presidential campaign. Well, you fooled me, President Zelensky. I thought you meant all that stuff about ending the civil war in the Donbass and giving Russia, your neighbor, some security assurances. I thought you were coming to your senses. Not a bit of it. In 2022, February, March, and April, you could have told Boris Johnson not to fly to Kiev to scupper the peace negotiations, but you chose not to. And then, in September 2022, according to world-renowned investigative reporter Seymour Hersh, you blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. If that turns out to be true, a blatant act of war and an extreme act of global terrorism, releasing, as it did, 300,000 tons of methane into the atmosphere over the Baltic Sea. First you, Mr. President, boasted openly about your intention and ability to do it, and then recently Victoria Nuland boasts about how pleased she is that it's a, quote, hunk of junk at the bottom of the sea. And Antony Blinken boasts how perfectly its destruction suits the US imperial agenda. And now, to cap it all off, you have your idiot mouthpiece, Nick Price, deny that the USA had anything to do with it. We have heard no statement from you, Mr. President. There is no mainstream media coverage. I guess you and the mainstream media think Cy Hirsch's piece and the mysterious exploding pipeline is just of no interest to the people. Enough is enough. We demand change. Do the right thing. Implement a ceasefire in Ukraine today. Imagine the collective sigh of relief across the globe. The outpouring of joy. The international joining of voices in harmony, singing an anthem to peace. Imagine John Lennon pumping the air with his fist from beyond the grave. You have finally been heard in the corridors of power. The big, dumb bullies in the schoolyard have agreed to stop playing nuclear chicken. We are not all going to die in a nuclear holocaust after all. At least, not today. Together, we the people can persuade the powers that be to drop the model of perpetual war as their accepted modus operandum. With the power of love, we will stop them from squandering our precious resources on their wars. We will be able to feed our children and keep them sheltered from the storm. We may even learn to cooperate with all our brothers and sisters of different ethnicities, religions, and nationalities, and save this, our beautiful planet home, from destruction. Wouldn't that be nice?
Roger Waters delivering a televised address at the February 19th Rage Against the War Machine. Hold on to your hat. We've got one more clip to play, but we're going to put John Grant on coming up right now. Hold on. John, are you there? John Grant.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Mike.
Loud and clear.
Hi. Okay. Loud
man,
and clear. Reach
man,
a five
man.
By five. Okay.
Right.
Fiverr, as we used to say.
I saved a clip for you personally. There's a lot of them. Listen, there's a lot of them if you go to the Rage Against the War Machine
right.
website, or they're popping up by the minute at the Gray Zone Project on the internet, and I snagged like three of them, before the show started. So I got one more. I thought I watched it, you know, on Sunday. I listened to it Sunday on a live stream.
Oh.
And I thought I got to play this for John. I got to play this clip for John Grant.
Oh, good. Okay, yeah, good. Go for it.
All right, can you hang with it, man? Can you hang? We'll talk after this. About 10 minutes.
I'm hanging, dude. I'm hanging, man.
You're gonna love this. You're gonna love this, John. I thought of our booklet. I published.
Okay.
And you wrote with containing your master article on General Smedley Butler.
Smedley.
We printed that article quite a while back now, but man.
Right.
When I heard this speech, I thought of John Grant. Listeners, you can order that booklet. I have some back copies still, and you can order it. It's the one with just when you write me, it's just send me the one with Trump wearing the buffalo horn, wearing the horn. Which, by the way, the image was designed by John Grant, none other.
It was a little Photoshop work I did there.
You did a great job on it. Don't worry about it. I loved it. And inside was the article on General Butler. And you're going to get a kick out of this. Here we go. This is Max.
Thank you, Nick. We're not supposed to be here today. They don't want you to be here. I'm going to talk about why that is. I'm going to address some of the people who don't want us to be here. They do not want an anti-war rally in this town. I want to talk to you as a son of Washington before I talk to you as a journalist. Someone who's known this city, who grew up in this city in the 1980s in this imperial capital. And I watched as my city was suddenly struck by a crack epidemic precisely at the same time that the CIA was seeking covert funding for its illegal wars in Latin America. And I watched as the streets of this city filled up with homeless Vietnam veterans, often still wearing their camouflage BDU, at the dawn of a homeless crisis that is now completely consuming our cities and which is apparent all around us. And it was only recently, just a few years ago actually, as I walked through Riverside Park by my home here in D.C. in Anacostia, that I noticed a small memorial to the Bonus Army, commemorating another generation of U.S. veterans who had been abandoned and betrayed by their government. Nearly 90 years ago, thousands of veterans of World War I gathered on Anacostia Flats and along the Potomac in Hoovervilles, makeshift camps, at the dawn of the Great Depression to demand the bonuses they had been promised and denied by the U.S. government. They had fought in a segregated army, but they now stood together and lived together as black men and white men. Some were supporters of communism. Some were supporters of the kind of America First style conservatism that was becoming in fashion at the time. And all were demonized by a government that saw this show of cultural and political unity as a threat to an empire in the making. Army Chief of Staff Douglas MacArthur warned that pacifism and its bedfellow communism are all around us, as he and the future heroes of the U.S. effort in World War II, Dwight Eisenhower and George Patton, sent their forces against these betrayed veterans. And on July 28, 1932, MacArthur and the U.S. Army attacked the Bonus Army and massacred them with tanks, cavalry, and machine guns, following orders to kill the men they had fought beside, below the U.S. flag in the trenches of Europe. And we stand here 90 years later in the same city where this massacre occurred, but countless disastrous wars later. And on the precipice of another economic crisis, we know that by coming here today, by coming together across artificial political boundaries and cultural lines imposed on us by our elites, we stand in the muddy boots of the Bonus Army as an imperial regime in deep decline trembles before us. And that's why it's so tragic to me that this rally has come under attack, not only by the usual suspects in the corporate media, but by sectarian forces that parade as progressive and anti-war. They say that right and left should not come together, that our petty differences must define and divide us, and that this rally is a danger to the movement. Well, let me speak now as a journalist who's met and lived with people on the other side of the guns of U.S. empire. Let me speak about the Palestinians I met in the rubble of Gaza who'd seen their families wiped out by U.S.-made missiles and howitzers fired by Israel's apartheid army simply because they dared to resist their dispossession. Let me speak to you about the Syrian people I met in Damascus who'd seen their cities surrounded by NATO-backed jihadist militias and who now withstand Israeli bombs and sadistic U.S. sanctions. Let me talk to you about the people I met in Venezuela, Nicaragua, in Cuba, the troika of resistance who have bravely weathered the storm of CIA destabilization plots and economic blockades. The people I know in the Horn of Africa, from Eritrea to Addis Ababa, who have seen 5 million people displaced by a U.S.-backed proxy war that few Americans even know took place. The Koreans I met, who've been separated from their own people and families by an imposed divide, who have not known peace since the genocidal U.S. war waged on them. And the people I know in the republics of Donbass and Lugansk, who have suffered for 9 years under the U.S.-supplied bombs of the Ukrainian military and its Sieg-Heiling neo-Nazi brigades, who celebrate and worship the Nazi collaborator Stepan Bandera, who murdered my own people in one pogrom after another. These people that I know and that I met on the other side of U.S. empire, they don't care if you're right-wing or left-wing. They don't care if you're a camo-clad Trumper or a progressive social justice activist. They don't care if you're vaccinated and masked and boosted. They don't care if you are libertarian or communist. All they want you to do is be out here today to rage against this sick, satanic, neoconservative war machine. That's what they want. Our corporate media, which is just a megaphone for our oligarchic elite, is constantly telling us who our enemies are. They said our enemy was in Serbia when I was a teenager. Then they said our enemy was in Afghanistan. Then they said our enemy was in Iraq. And maybe our enemy was down the street in the local mosque. And we are here today to say that we know who our real enemy is. Our enemy is not in Russia. Our enemy is you, the corporate media, and the oligarchy that you speak for. Our enemy is the empire that's robbed us of our rights, that's looted our treasury for its insane imperial regime change wars, and that has hounded and jailed real journalists like Julian Assange. They say we need to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them here. We say that we will fight the neoconservatives over here before they kill millions more over there. Can you dig it? That's not our war. Whether in Ukraine or the war they're planning over the Straits of Taiwan, their war is not our war. Our war is for the hundreds of thousands of homeless people sleeping in the cold. Our war is to clean up our rivers. Our war is to fix our crumbling schools and roads. Our war is to fight for the minds of our brothers and sisters subjected to a nonstop tidal wave of corporate media propaganda. Our war starts here. Our war starts today. Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Thank you.
Max Blumenthal.
That's Max Blumenthal?
Yep, from the Gray Zone. Yep.
Well, he's fired up, let me tell you.
What did he say? Well, let me just finish up, and then I want to hear what your thoughts are. I beg to inform you, John Grant, I beg to inform you that the New York chapter of Vets for Peace, I saw a banner there, a big banner, black and white banner the New York chapter of Vets for Peace. Okay, John, what are your thoughts about this phenomenon?
Well, first of all, I saw some pictures with Vets for Peace, certainly. And I've been running around the track with a number of people in Vets for Peace about this issue. So this is not new. I mean, I've been predicting this for a year or so, at least. I don't understand what's going on, and I don't know what's going to happen, and I'm not sure who I support in all this. It's become quite complicated and confusing to me at times. I don't have the certainty of a Max Blumenthal. I mean, I know the horrors and I know the crimes that the United States has done. We can start with Columbus, of course, and and the slaughter of Indians, Manifest Destiny, the railroads, and slavery, Jim Crow. We know the horrors of militarism and racism in America. It's an old story, and it has to be told, retold over and over again with every Reconstruction movement we're living in. Like now we're in the third Reconstruction after the Civil War, the Civil Rights Movement. We need to know about that. But I guess my problem with this right-left coalition is I see a lot of needs for right-left coalitions, a lot of the need to break down the polarization and the lunacy that we live in and we've grown to live in, especially as it's been goosed up with the Trump movement and all that, and the Internet and Twitter, et cetera, where we're all basically, frantic and losing our minds, we need to, a lot of things that the right talks about, in a sensible way, you tone down the rhetoric and the decibels, that, they do have a point. There is a point there, but it gets lost in all the absolute craziness and hyperbole in the speeches and even what Max Blumenthal was going on about. This is a speech given to get the blood up of however many hundreds or thousands of people are in front of him. So, he's not talking about things like truth and things like that. He's trying to stir people up. So what we get is, there is a base, a need to break this polarization and to cross polarized lines and to actually, use things on the right, like in my case, identity politics. I think it's actually the left shooting itself in the foot. We can talk about that later. And so how do you get this sort of, seepage between right and left so that we can actually get to something in this culture that makes sense in how we live and the various types of people we are? And then this war comes up. And what do we do with this war? As I've said to my friends who are, talking like Max Blumenthal in that speech you just played, I say, well, this is fine. I don't have any problem with that speech. It's that somehow in this horrible war in Ukraine that we're in the middle of, it's on, how do we get into the ideologies that's struggling in this war to figure this out? Well, we can't just condemn the United States and then let Vladimir Putin and this Russian invasion off the hook. I mean, it's almost medieval, some of the way that we've sort of reverted from the 20th century rise of, the UN and things like that after World War II. We're now, reverting to, former campaigns like, out of the 16th century or something. So I don't know. I mean, it's like, I don't sound like I have much certainty in this, obviously. I don't know. What do you? I'm mumbling around here. What do you think of my comments here? Let me hand it over to you here.
Well, here's what I'm going to do. I think first off, well, here's what, and we could discuss this. I had a guy. First off, we're outnumbered out here incredibly. It's like one.
Of course.
One
well,
in
we
three,
know that.
Probably one in four. One in four people out here are probably registered Democrats. And I'm seriously thinking about dropping out of the Democratic Party, mainly because I'm so fed up with the culture wars that are constantly going on, as I suspect that I strongly suspect that we're just, closer and closer. Today, example, Putin gave a speech before his supporters in the Duma, saying that we're going to walk away from the START treaty, the nuclear START treaty.
Right.
Okay, and I'm not real happy.
Right.
I mean, I see brinkmanship on both sides.
Absolutely.
I see Biden.
That's why I say
Biden,
a plague on both their houses. You know.
Blumenthal,
people like that don't seem to come to the thing with, okay, let's damn the United States, but let's also damn Russia here, and let's get these two goddamned parties to cut the crap and sit down and figure this out. But you're right, the media, MSNBC is the worst of all. It pumps up this war like crazy. It was beside itself yesterday reporting on Joe Biden's, very risky train ride from, Poland into Ukraine in an ordinary civilian train, And, of course, it's interesting that Joe Biden informed the Russian government. It didn't tell the American people. It told a lot of other people. It told the Russian government and Putin that it was taking a train into Kyiv. And, it was a deconfliction, it was called. It was an effort. It was a demand that Russia deconfliction of that area. In other words, don't drop a bomb anywhere near the President of the United States or, the shit will get deeper and deeper.
That's a bullshit word, deconfliction. You know it.
Of course
that,
it
does.
Well,
trip,
listen, I mean it as a bullshit word. Listen, don't do this to me. Don't tell me it's a bullshit word. I'm using it as a bullshit word, of course.
That's the
word they use. I mean, these crazy words get used all the time in wars. We know them from Vietnam and all this. But that's what they called it. And in effect, that's what happened. They didn't send in a bomb and blow up Joe Biden.
No. Who is they? You're talking about the Russians? Of course.
Right.
Well, look,
right.
But what did the Ukrainians do, and what did Joe Biden do? He got up and
well, Joe Biden had an appointment with the president of Ukraine.
It was more than
for a
that.
Big TV show. It was a big TV show.
Yeah, he was.
No question about it.
When they entered, they set off air raid sirens as he was going into the. I mean, that's the government. That's the Ukrainians terrifying their own people.
I'm not saying
true,
it's not a shit show PR show. Of course it is. I mean, of course it was a PR show. It was all bullshit, okay, maybe the guy did take a risk, but I don't think he took much of a risk. He had more of a risk of tripping on his dick and looking like a fool, and he's walking around, he's like 80 years old, it was a PR show, but I mean, somehow this is the world we're caught in, and this idea that somehow because we're so earnest and we scream on the streets and, you know, this and that, that somehow it's going to change it. You know, this has been a runaway train since Vietnam. I mean, the peace movement in the United States is, I hate to break this bubble, but, you know, we've pretty much failed in the ways we've done this. That's my position. It's like, sure, I think they should stop this war, both sides, absolutely. This is ridiculous, and it's only wasting money, it's wasting lives, it's wasting, you know, all this stuff. But, you know, nobody's listening to me, but are they listening to Max Bloom?
Oh, yeah, there's
there?
People listening to you, John, right now.
Well, no, I know that. I know that, but...
We're not talking in a vacuum here.
That's not
know,
my.
So.
That wasn't my point. That wasn't my point. But I think we're in a terrible position. I think we're in a position absolutely analogous to 1914, for instance, when the world came unglued because it was living in the past, and suddenly the technological future had to catch up with them, and it caught up with them in all those trenches in France, you know, and things like that. You know, and we're running the same kind of thing here in 2023. And, you know, people tried to stop, you know, after World War One, people tried to stop the rise of the war into, you know, the continuation, if you will, into frustration of World War One into World War Two in Europe. And, you know, they couldn't stop it. Albert Einstein, Sigmund Freud, you know, they used to send all these letters back and forth about what to do with humankind, you know, headed towards, you know, this huge conflagration again, and there was absolutely nothing they could do. You know, I hate to be like Chicken Little here, but, you know, I guess what the problem I see with this this Rage Against the War Machine right-left affair in Washington is that I think it's an absolute setup. I think it's Tucker Carlson is a recruiter for this thing. I've watched it, and you know they're creating a movement that links the populist right and the populist left on, you know, cutting the defense budget focused on the Ukraine war, so that you're going to get a coalition of right populists and left populists that are opposed to this war in Ukraine, because they wanted to, you know, the left wants to, you know, as they've done for decades and decades, wants to eliminate the militarism and, you know, the defense budget. Well, if you take the money we've spent and stop spending on Ukraine, that's a lot of money. Well, the right, you know, I don't think the right really cares what's going on in Ukraine, but it wants to empower its, you know, authoritarian elements in the United States, which, as we know, have, you know, questionably but linked with, you know, Putin and Orban and all these other authoritarians in the world, so that this linkage between left and right against the hated deep state, which both the left and right populists hate this deep state, you know, they rail against it like Blumenthal just did. So what does that do? That empowers the Trumpian right, which is DeSantis, whoever that might be, in 2024. So here we are. You know,
where were you?
You know what
where
I'm saying? I don't have the answer. I don't have the answers. I just have a lot of questions. That's all.
Well, I've been watching these guys pretty closely for a couple of years.
Sure.
And right. Recently, before this Rage Against the War Machine rally, they were constantly. I don't know. Do you want me to give my good part or the bad part? Okay, the good part is this. I'll give you the good part.
Oh, everybody, I don't care which you go.
Okay, the bad part, when I first started hearing about this, I was reminded of 1968 in Chicago. Oh.
Right.
When the whole shit storm all came down with the anti-war movement against Vietnam, okay?
Right.
And it was, and listeners, you can go to YouTube and watch the riot. It was riots outside the Democratic Party convention.
Right. Assassinations, it was a big year, right.
it was a hell of a mess outside the Democratic Party convention.
No question.
Agreed?
Absolutely. Right.
Okay.
Oh, no question.
It was a party deeply divided, even at the convention. And
absolutely.
And what happened? Well, Nixon got elected out of that.
Absolutely. There you go. Yeah.
Okay. Now here's something I want to say directly to the nationwide audience. This is in the context of 1968, 2024, the election coming up.
Okay.
The New Republic, which has some good articles and some that I don't agree with, but hey, I read them. It's sort of a left-right periodical. And there's an article by Walter Shapiro, who is a big shot, in the New Republic magazine. And he cites another guy who I'll refer to, but it's in this month's issue, March 2023, by Walter Shapiro. And he cites a guy like a mathematician and a database guy, very with big, big cred, street cred on computers, that he points out, here's the headline, last November 2022, more than 107 million Americans voted, and the Democrats lost the House by a mere 6,675 votes in five congressional districts. And the article goes into a deep, deep dive, and those numbers are accurate. They lost five congressional districts over 6,675 votes. They lost the whole majority they had in the House of Representatives over that little minuscule amount in five districts for the House of Representatives. This is the bad stuff. I was sitting there thinking, man, we might be facing another situation like that where the Democrats lose big time because they're not anti-war, okay? And half of their domestic economic policies have not played out. Bernie Sanders on Face the Nation this last Sunday. Bernie Sanders did a great job defending his domestic policies, but he had to admit it's far from what it should be. Joe Biden couldn't get it through or something. I mean, I'm just telling you, you can watch Face the Nation on YouTube with Bernie Sanders this last Sunday. Now, I like Bernie, but this is the bad side. Now, here's the good side. Could be the good side, okay, on the anti-war coalition. In 1980, as Reagan was coming into power, there was a Central Park demonstration, one of the largest in the history of the city of New York City, of over a million people. And it was just the beginning, and there were many other demonstrations, and it was all about nuclear disarmament. I think many people, including conservatives, were worried about Reagan getting elected, and at that time, the Russians were not backing down either in the nuclear arms race. And it took 2 years, but look what happened. Reagan went and signed these treaties, okay? And it was Nixon did the START treaty, but there was a series of treaties which did lead to the destruction of nuclear warheads. It happened at Greenham Columns in England. This disarmament movement spanned the globe, and that was in 1980. You know, years after the failure of the anti-war movement to stop the war in Vietnam. It really didn't stop it. In 68, it had been brewing since 64, some people say. 68 was sort of a fissure point where things fell apart, and it really didn't end until, what, 74, when we saw 73, 74, 75. Hell, they were still there in 75 with Gerald Ford as president.
75 was last year.
Yeah, that was the absolute last year, you know. But so what I'm saying is,
out and took Saigon, et cetera, you know.
Yeah, thank you. You were there, I wasn't. So my point is, if you take the good side of organizing a vast, widespread, popular movement for nuclear disarmament, treaties, peace negotiations, you know, or we can just keep, or the Democrats could really get slaughtered in 2024. Okay, that's
right.
My opinion. Very good, Bert. Because I think they,
well, you know, I think you have a point to, obviously the Democrats could totally lose the show. We could have DeSantis as president, and a Republican Senate and a Republican House, and then we on the left would be sent to the desert and would be royally fucked. You know, I think that is a scenario. That's what I think all of us, anybody left of center or Democrat or progressive or whatever the hell you want to call yourself, I think, you know, that really motivates people. That terrifies people. That really frightens them and, you know, it scares me. So you adjust your politics in a realistic, pragmatic way to forego that so that doesn't happen. And so, you know, the Democrats are, it seems to me, moving to the center at the same time. And like Biden, and people argue this, has moved, he's very much a centrist, let's put him that way. He's always been a centrist, and, you know, he's like LBJ, he's a master of legislative process, so to speak, and he loves to talk across the aisle, whether it's to Strom Thurmond, or, you know, the famous racist Dixiecrat who became a Republican, who he ass-kissed and threw out, you know, a lot of things, you know, like the Clarence Thomas hearings, et cetera, so he made his career on talking across the aisle and all this kind of stuff, being a centrist. And I think, you know, that's what the Democrats have decided, given the you know, a significant slice of the country is going off the beam on the far, far right in a way that many of us wouldn't have expected 5 years ago, you know, or 6 years ago. So anyway, that's where we are. So this is driving the Democratic Party to be more centrist. That's why you have, you know, people like Hakeem Jeffries as the minority leader in the House. You know, he didn't make AOC the, you know, minority leader. This guy's a fairly centrist sort of political type. And this war is in the middle of all this. You know, I think the war is a disaster, and God, it should have never happened, like all of our wars, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan. You know, there's scenarios where it didn't happen, but once it happened, as Vets for Peace likes to say, wars are easy to start and hard to stop. You know, once it's going full bore, which it is now, you know, the year anniversary is not a reflection point or whatever where it's going to go the other way and de-escalate. You know, we're in a year anniversary here and the thing is escalating. And that's a fact of life, you know, that I don't know how many demonstrations it's going to take to end that. You know, I mean, it's something that's just a fact of life. It's a runaway train. How do you stop the runaway train? I don't know. But I don't think you stop it by advocating, you know, one side is evil and needs to stop financing their side of the war, that is the United States, because if that happens, we will once again, abandon and betray, like we did the Vietnamese, like we've done everybody in our wars. You know, we will loosen the football then by setting them up and then abandoning them. And, you know, Russia will then win, and Russia will, you know, Vladimir Putin will take this as a, he's Peter the Great. You know, it paid off that they slogged their way through and lost 225,000 men. It's necessary. God bless them. They did this for the Russian future, for the new Peter the Great empire, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. And then, of course, you got the linkage with the Trumpian elements that admire Viktor Orban, the sort of soft Putin in Hungary and things like that. I don't know if the left will – what is the left going to do if its involvement as a spoiler in the 2024 election actually does accrue to – Ron DeSantis squeaking in as President of the United States, maybe even not winning the popular vote, but clearly winning the Electoral College vote, which, of course, they're counting on. And then what? You know, especially if they have the Congress. The Iraq war or the Ukraine war will be ended, theoretically, because the Trumpian elements have not liked Zelensky and Ukraine from the beginning. They've always hated the idea of NATO. They wanted NATO to stop doing what it was doing. And so I don't know. It's just that it seems that in because we're so against war, this war, to stop it now after it's fully inflamed and going, to stop it on a one-sided way just because, you know, we're unhappy with it here in the United States, and then because Americans have lost enthusiasm for it, the place is then finally trounced to war of attrition, by the Russian onslaught. But why would the Russians then want to stop when they've Putin's Peter the Great fantasies are so rewarded? Where's he going to go next? And they would have to stop him next, this is a reflection, a reheating of the Cold War, yes, but it's also a fact of life. It's history. It's happening. And I think we have to begin to deal with things on that level, that sure, the United States has done horrible things in the past, and it probably did blow up that pipeline, because it didn't want the Germans to be weakened and capitulate to their need for oil in this pipeline coming into Germany. So the United States CIA just blew the fucker up. Okay, the CIA are a bunch of shitbags. They've always been a bunch of shitbags. So, okay, it's a fact of life, though. What do you point out that the CIA might have done it, as Cy Hirsch did, but Americans are so jaded with this stuff, they'd say, okay, big deal. What are you going to do? But so what? CIA always does horrible things. And, as do the Russians, everybody does horrible things these days in secret. I don't know. I'm going off here, but I'll back away. And what do you think? Am I out of my mind?
I don't know about you. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I mean,
okay.
I'll tell you this.
You won't diagnose me on air. Okay, good.
I don't know. Yeah. Well, it's obvious that you're sort of in a, I think elections are reflected by mass movements. Mass movements are
but maybe in the last 10 years, the mass movements have reflected, the elections have reflected mass movements. I think there's a lot of young people, and who blames them, are extremely pissed off at what the so-called elders, including the radical elders.
Absolutely. I think you're
I have a 25-year-old son, 24-year-old son who, you know, I can hear it, you know, in his voice when we talk about this kind of stuff. And I think the Democratic Party should lead the charge in not investigating President Biden's son Hunter's penis pictures. I think they should lead the charge in investigating the sabotage as an act of war of the Nord Stream pipeline. They can do that. I think they should.
In other words, you're saying make it instead of a secret rumor, make it a Cy Hirsch, make it a fait accompli and a fact. In other words, expose the truth.
And furthermore, join in coalitions with some rather distasteful, disgusting individuals in calling for, if not reducing the budget of the Pentagon, at least stop sending so many weapons abroad, not just Ukraine, but everywhere, and close down some of these goddamn 750 to 800 bases. Many of them are so secret. We're building three more in the Philippines. Three new military bases in the Philippines.
I guess what I was like ranting about for the last 10 minutes was that. But how can you do that when we have a incredibly lethal war going on? That's what it means when we say wars are very, very hard to stop. I don't know. I mean, I do. Maybe I watch too much MSNBC and all this, this stuff from Ukraine. You get a lot of emotional stuff. You get a lot of, good people really suffering, and beautiful story about a young, beautiful couple. They joined the military together, and they were both blown up together in a bunker. These personal stories of Ukrainians who are, suffering under this cruel and brutal Russian onslaught. I mean, that's a narrative. That's the pro-U.S. war narrative that is, that Blumenthal railed against in the media. It's there. There's no question about it. The New York Times does it all the time. In fact, the New York Times today, where the hell is it here? They have the war summed up in a way that's, where is it here? Oh, yeah, on the front page, this is a story. For Biden, night of risks on way to besieged Kyiv. President and Putin, two worldviews. As Christ of Putin's war of conquest is failing, Biden declares. 1 year later, Biden says, Kyiv stands and Ukraine stands, democracy stands. And this is now the New York Times, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, the fifth paragraph down, in which they explain the war. This is the nut, called in the business the nut paragraph. This is the nut. The war in Ukraine is about power and the principle of territorial sovereignty and whether the Western-designed global order that Americans thought would prevail for decades will, in fact, survive new challenges from Moscow and Beijing. But it is increasingly a contest between two cold warriors, one 70 years old and another who just turned 80, who have been circling each other for years and now are engaged in everything short of direct battle. Now, you know, that seems like if you're going to reduce this to a paragraph, I mean, that's fair. But, you know, it's a pretty screwed up situation. That is a dysfunctional situation when you've got two cold warriors now, you know, 70 and 80 going at each other in some personal vendetta kind of way, you know. I mean, it's crazy. It's fucking crazy. As I say, a plague on both their houses. But how do you, you know, how do you accomplish it? How do you get to, in the middle of a, you know, a hot war, lethal hot war, you know, how do you turn it off? I don't know. The peace movement hasn't been very good with that track record in the United States. My experience with war in the United States and around is that wars stop when people get fed up with them. You know, it takes time, and people have to get sick and tired. You know, as Fannie Lou Hamer said, sick and tired of being sick and tired, you know.
Well, do you think we're at that point now? John,
no, I
don't.
Unfortunately, I don't think. I mean, Americans. The stories now appearing that Americans are wearying of supporting Ukraine because it's, you know, Vladimir Putin has made it clear. You know, he doesn't care. He'll keep throwing young Russian boys into this thing. He doesn't give a shit, and. You know, and that Deripaska, whatever her name is, the guy that does the Wagner Group, the mercenaries, and incredible private mercenary army, you know, the Wagner Group. You know, and how do you stop this Anschlag or whatever they used to call it in the 40s, you know, with Hitler? You know, the Anschlag. How do you stop this? You know, I don't know. Granted, it's a very moral position. It's a position to take to stand up in public and beat your chest and say this war is wrong. It's terribly immoral. It's wrong. I would agree 100% with that. But that doesn't do much good to stop it, you know.
Well,
that's my position, you know.
It's an old cliche among the old Republicans,
right.
I know, and they're just as
I'm
talking some clay-headed Republicans, okay?
Right.
That they say, oh, the Democrats always get us into a war, and the Republicans get us out of war. Historical proof. I ask them that. Harry Truman
Nixon supposedly got us out of Vietnam,
I'll be very short.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. My bad.
Okay.
Please do.
This is the old clay-headed, hard-back Republicans. Harry Truman got us into Korea. Ike got us negotiated out. We got out after Ike got elected. Okay.
Right.
Then
Truman got us into Vietnam.
Some say LBJ accelerated it. Okay. These same
Republicans. Well, obviously at that point it was a full-blown thing then. Yeah. But it was
Truman
at the beginning could have prevented 30 years of Vietnam War. He could have done exactly Franklin Roosevelt probably would have done, is go along
There's
and
more.
Give the Vietnamese their independence. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go
There's
ahead.
More. I'm still speaking like the old hard-headed, hard-back Republicans. I guess I'll use I'll use the voice. Harry Truman got us into Korea. Ike got us out.
Right.
Okay, Mike, are you listening, Mike? And then
way to go.
Harry Truman and that goddamn Texan, Lyndon B. Johnson, got us into Vietnam. Nixon got us out. And,
oh, God, good old Dickie. Good old Dickie.
George
H. W. We love Dick.
George
we love Dick.
George H. W. Bush
Papa Doc. He got us into Iraq and Kuwait, but at least he got us out with the United Nations. His goddamn dumb son, George Bush Jr., he got us into Iraq and blew the whole thing up and turned us the world into a piece of shit.
Okay, that's what the old Republicans tell us.
Well, I tell you, there's some truth to that, but there's also a lot of bullshit involved in that. Well, you know, Nixon did get us out of Vietnam, of course. What, it took him like, what, 10 years or something?
at least two to three million Vietnamese and Cambodians and Laotians.
Right.
And I mean, it was a fucking mess, man.
Yeah, I somehow can't get my weary mind around the idea of Richard Nixon as a peacemaker. Somehow there's always a blockage. I can't quite get that narrative down, you know. I don't know why.
I'm just telling you what they say. The Democrats get
they,
into the war, Republicans
they,
get it.
Right. But like most things in politics of that order, it's simplistic. And as I say, the reality is much, much more complicated and less absolute when it comes to one party or the other. I think both parties are guilty of our American wars. Both parties are guilty of all the horrors that this country has tried to bury, you know, from the manifest destiny and slaughter of Indians, you know, to slavery and Jim Crow and et cetera, you know, where... Now look at Florida. Oh my God, they're like cats trying to cover up all their shit. You know, it's just crazy. You know. Don't report on that incident. That makes my white boy son feel sad because he's really a good boy. He's really a good boy. He really loves black people.
Oh, I got
Grant's
impression. That's good.
You're right. Well, my wife tells me that when you talk to a cat, they like it when you talk to them, and it's all set out somehow. Gives them a friendly vibe.
Oh, wow.
But that's cat.
cat talk. There's nothing wrong with that, I'll tell you. Well, let's think some more about it. Let's think some more about this until next Tuesday.
I like that idea. Let's think some more about this. That's good. That's good. That's what we need to do. We need to allow more information in, and that's what we need to do in Florida. We need to just swamp the goddamn place with information somehow. So, you know, Ron DeSantis can stand up there in his big meat hook face, and he can say, "Well, this is the state where woke goes to die." Okay.
Well, Kansas.
That means we're all asleep. In other words, woke goes to die because we're all asleep in Florida. You know.
We're going to finish
all
with
right.
the saber dance, I'll tell you.
All right.
All right.
Oh, it sounds like the serpent.
All right, John Grant.
All right, Mike.
John Grant. All right, brother.
Have a good week.